just encourage you to read that. Okay, so on to what we're talking about this week, which is elements of music and their relationship specifically to musical form. Before we get on to that, we need to talk about what we mean by musical form. So just a few sort of general points. Everything we listen to, well, I'll quantify that. The vast majority of what we listen to has a specific structure. Okay? Most popular music that we listen to has got a specific structure. And the sort of terminologies that we're used to using are things like introduction, verse, chorus, middle eight, guitar solo, ending. They're the sort of terminologies that we've got used to, and you know, you don't need to study music to get used to that sort of terminology. This is another generalisation that we're going to look at today. The vast majority of popular music that we listen to, and I'm talking about by popular music, I mean everything, like rock, all the genres, everything, sort of, let's just call it popular music, okay? Most of the stuff we listen to, you'll find, is divided up into two and four bar phrases. We'll come on to, in a few weeks' time, what I mean by a phrase, but you'll find that the verses and the choruses, quite often, are made up of 4, 8, and 16 bars. They're multiples of two, and that's something that has developed over not just decades, but actually over hundreds of years. You could analyse the Mozart symphony, and you would find that a lot of his symphonies are made up of exactly the same rules that we apply to popular music. And what it does, it creates an expectation in us when we listen to this music. We almost know when the chorus is going to happen, even if you haven't heard the music before. You listen to it, you think, okay, the chorus is going to come in here, and it does. And Mike O'Hara last year, this year, I don't know when he brings it up, but he probably mentioned Theodore Adorno. You mentioned Adorno, and the idea of standardisation in popular music. That's one of the things that he's talking about. That was one of the critiques that Adorno had. It was very broad. It didn't just include this, but one of the critiques was that the form was the same. I've got real issues with Adorno's critique, which is for another time, but these are one of the things he's talking about. So let's just... A few musicologists have called this the rule of four. So this music, which has been divided into twos, fours, eights, 16s, 32s, 64s, so on and so forth, that's the music that we listen to, the majority of it. Some people call it the rule of four. And let's just listen to a few examples. I'll show you what we're going to listen to first, because I'll have to then take it off the screen. So we're going to listen. I looked at the top 20 over the weekend. In fact, the top 10 I looked at. And these three records are in the top 10. So we're going to listen to a little bit of that. All of those records all stick to this. And we'll listen to those extracts of those four records. They're all in the top 10 at the moment. So let's start off just by listening to extracts of those. Okay, so just take it off the screen for the moment. And while you're listening to it, can I ask you to count? I don't know if this is an exercise you've done before, you probably have, but just get used to it. And try and sort of keep in mind what I'm saying. You know when the verses are going to happen, even if you haven't heard this piece of music before, which in these cases, I think you would have heard them before. But let's just listen to this. So what have you got here?
Because you know I'm all about that.
You've got no intro, no introduction, which is quite unusual. So how many bars in the verse? Eight. And you've got sort of a rap version of the verse, which is how many bars?
Eight.
Number eight. So this is like the verse. They're all in eight. Everything's in eight. So this isn't the John Legend track. This time you have got the introduction. Really common. That normally happens. Four bar introduction. So how many bars there? Eight.
What's going on in that beautiful mind?
We sort of know when it's going to end, don't we? We don't even have to count. You know, like, okay, you've never heard this before. You think something's going to change here. And it does. That's the first phrase. This is like a bridge. And that's eight bars. Chorus. First off.
All your curves and all your edges, all your perfect imperfections.
You get the idea. Same thing as the last track. Same formula.
Give my all.
Isn't the next one? So again, you've got an intro. So there's the four bar intro. Count this, you could count it. One, two, three. Or some people might go. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Doesn't matter, it's the same formula. One. That's like four bars there. Five. Six. Something's gonna change, and it does. It's exactly the same formula. Eight bars, four bar intro. Same formula. Four. Last example. Again, no intro. But you got the rule of eight again? Where are we? Five? Going to end? If you've never heard it before, you would think here. And it repeats. Because it's repeated, it'll definitely change here. So you can see what Adorno meant when he was talking about formulaic popular music. The form of virtually everything we listen to. I know we're choosing pop music in the traditional sense here, but it goes way beyond that. Let's just listen to some other examples. Here's a track from 1970. But again, what we're going to do, I'll have to do this in stages because I can't play the music at the same time as showing you the slide. What we'll listen to is, listen to a 1970 track, Elton John, Bits Of. We'll listen to a 1939 track by Vera Lynn. And we'll also listen to a bit of Mozart's symphony from 1788. And they all fit the same sort of rules. The Mozart one's a bit more tedious. I could have probably chosen a better example.
Oh, Symphony 40's lovely.
Eh?
Symphony 40's lovely.
It's a great bit of music. I don't know if it's the best example of what I'm talking about, but anyway. Elton John, there's the intro. Four bar intro again. So on the fourth bar, the fifth, So what can happen here? The seventh. It's either going to repeat or there's going to be a chorus. It repeats, I think. So you've got two verses before the chorus, really common. So it's sort of inbuilt in us, with this awareness of eight bars. I think I could do this with a class of 10-year-olds and they'd be able to tell when the chorus came in because of cultural conditioning. And then you get a chorus. So it's the same formula as the stuff that's around today. That's the point I'm trying to prove. Let's listen to the next track. There's the intro. Two bars. This was a huge hit after the First World War. Again, it fits into eight bars. Going to be repeated. And if you, even if you haven't heard this before, you know there's going to be a change, don't you? There's a change coming up here. You just know it. There will be a change here. And there is. And you know when the change is going to come to an end?
They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing.
It's going to go back to the verse. Look, I think I've proven the point. Listen to the music with that sort of ear. The rule of four, the rule of eight, it's everywhere. It's not just the music that we're listening to today, it goes back decades. It goes back even to the time, if you listen to Mozart, Beethoven, you'll hear it there as well. So we're culturally conditioned to do this, both as listeners and as songwriters. Analyse your own songwriting, the chances are it'll fit in with this. Certainly if you're trying to be commercially successful. We'll come across some examples of people who don't comply with this in a second, but you know, it's very, very common. So what about music that doesn't fit into this common structure? Before I give you them, let's listen to them. No, I'll show you them first. Let's listen to a track by the Civil Wars, the band The Civil Wars. So let's just listen to this and see if you can tell me what's unusual about it, I suppose. Let's just do that. So how does it not fit in with So you've got your intro. Eight bars. Talk about that today, but you could ask the question, Why? How, what is it that makes it still so imbalanced? The fact, despite the fact that you've got an 8-bar verse followed by a 6-bar verse, you could explore that. Let's listen to slightly older track. So what's going on with this? So 4-bar intro, no 8-bar intro. More than 8-bar intro. So see him count it. Despite the fact it sounds balanced, and it's to do with the melody, it's the melody that makes it sound balanced. Quite often a lot of phrases of that earlier music we listened to, the melody was split up into 4-bar phrases, so you had like a 4-bar question phrase, and it was answered by a 4-bar answer phrase. With this track, it's done slightly different, it's not done in questions and answers in the same way. So consequently, you get this weird mixture, you know, you could think of it as 6 plus 2 7s, there's a couple of different ways that you can count it. It's actually ambiguous, and that creates interest, but it still sounds melodic. And they're the sort of things, I think, that are interesting to explore. You know, you can you could look at an artist and go back through their back catalogue, and it might be, you know, it depends who you analyse, but it might be that all of their music's just standardised in 4s, 8s, 16s. But there might be some interesting variations. This tendency started, I mean, certainly going back to the Beatles, a lot of those Motown tracks from the 60s, what you would find, because there was a lot of jazz musicians playing those records, people like Dinah Ross and the Supremes and the Four Tops and bands like this, what they would quite often do is like put extra bars on the end of verses and choruses. So you'd find, you'd sort of expect the chorus to happen, there's like a delay and then it comes in. So what happens is, your expectation of what's going to happen is delayed. It does happen, but it's delayed, and that's quite a clever songwriting technique. That's what you're going to do as a songwriter, I would propose. It's about managing the expectations of the listener. If every time you play something, what the listener expects to happen doesn't happen, you're not going to get a commercially successful piece of music. You might do well in other fields, but in terms of top 20, it's not going to happen normally. You've got to fulfill the expectations of what the listeners want. And that's why Adorno thought it was a production line. You know, it wasn't really art, it was a production line, which has got a lot of skill involved in it. Now, what you find as well, so, you know, we've talked about how the music can be divided up into predetermined sections, which are normally 4s and 8s, but there's a lot of music out there that doesn't do that. And I'm suggesting to you that you begin to listen to that, see if you can make sense of it. But what you find, like we said last week, The interest has to come from somewhere when you're listening to music. The elements, the interest has to come from somewhere. I can say this, sections usually contrast from one another melodically. So when you've got a change of section, usually the melody changes. I challenged the class last year to come up with a piece of music where the verse and the chorus has the same melody. I'll ask you the same. No one could come up with that example, with the verse and the chorus using the same melody. I'm sure there is an example. I couldn't find one, but I'd be interested if you could. Verse and chorus, but it's a definite chorus, but it's the same melody as the verse. What you normally get is the melody changes when you come to the chorus. That's the norm. That sustains interest. But what you also find when you come to the chorus, usually, what happens? The chords change. These are just general tendencies. You know, you've got a verse, you come to the chorus, the chords change. That's just what we do normally. Normally, I say. But what you also find quite often when you go between verses and choruses is that the texture changes. So quite often the texture of the music won't stay the same. That'll also change. And these are things that, you know, when we listen to these things, we just take them for granted. We don't even think about it. But if you start analysing these things with a sort of a scientific mind, my argument is not only would you be better musicologists in terms of passing this module, you'd be better songwriters, better musicians, because you'll begin to understand the way that music's put together. And, of course, what you also get when you move from the verse to the chorus is the norm is the lyrics change. And the chorus, I mean, you probably already know this, but the reason it's called the chorus is that's the bit that traditionally people sang along to. You know, going back to the Victorian age, that's when everybody joined in. And we still do that today. It's the repeated bit of the song, the chorus. So it's normally different from the verse. And like we discovered, you know, you also get differences in dynamic and also rhythm between the verses and the choruses. So songwriters, arrangers, whatever you want to call them, are very skillful at putting together, certainly with pop music, it can be quite simplistic ideas, but they're put together in such a way where they sustain interest. And that, despite the fact that I don't listen to 120 very much these days, I respect it as a craft. You know, people make money off it, and I respect it as a craft because it's not easy to do that. Let's just listen to a few examples of what I'm talking about. So we're going to listen to two tracks. We'll listen to a Seymour Ross track. And what I want you to do, you might just want to make a note of these factors that we're talking about, because again, I'll have to go off the page. But if you think of the melody, the harmony, the texture, the lyrics, the dynamics, and the rhythm. But both of them. We'll just listen to a bit of both of them. And just how are they manipulating those elements between the verse and the chorus? That's the question I'm asking you. There might be other elements that they're manipulating. So how do they create an interest between the verse and the chorus? Seymour Ross is they sometimes sing in English, sometimes in Icelandic, but they actually sing in a language that doesn't exist, called Homeland. I think it's called Homeland. And what that means is the meaning in the music transcends the lyrics. It means something beyond the lyrics, which I quite like. You can sort of put your own lyrics to the song. I think this might be an example. Listen to it.
It's pretty light as well, but I love those songs.
Yeah.
It's
pretty quiet. Yeah.
Is it blue?
less is more. Silence, which I think is one of the traits that I like about their music, where it can go down to not, you know, it's almost you can hear the breath of the singer, so quiet, but it can also get very, very loud as well. And it's, yeah, I would say dynamics and texture. There wasn't a lot of rhythmic variation in that, but certainly dynamics there was, texture, melody, I think, you know, yeah, it's quite varied melody. Difficult to talk about the harmony. The lyrics, like I say, with that particular track, are actually made up. So, you know, you might think, well, in which case there's nothing to say about them. But how about that, the whole interest of sort of taking away the subject content of a lyric so that you can actually put your own meaning into the lyric. That's what the idea is with that. I'm not going to listen to the Snow Patrol tracks. It's the same idea. It's you know, how the ways in which the elements are used to create interest between the sections. So what we're talking about specifically this time, we're talking about how it impacts the form. That's what I'm trying to put across to you. How the elements of music impact the form of the music. All right, let's just move on, because we've got quite a lot to listen to. So how can instrumentation and texture, how can that determine form? This particular track's quite interesting. I'm trying to give you a few different examples from different genres. But when you've only got one section, i.e. you've got no chorus, if the texture was kept the same, the piece of music would be boring. So if you've got a piece of music which has only got one section, the interest has to come from somewhere. And what you find in this, Brian Wilson, the producer Brian Wilson, was an absolute master of this, where he would use the recording studio as a compositional tool, usually made up of himself, normally be him, just him, although it was put across as the Beach Boys, it was usually just him and session players. Certainly on Pet Sounds it was, anyway, on the album Pet Sounds. But just listen to this, the way that one section of music with no chorus can develop interest because of the elements of music, because of texture. Again, this might have, has anyone heard Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys? You should listen to it. It's one of the classic albums. It's on a par with Sgt. Pepper's by the Beatles. It's like, if you're into literature, you've got to read Shakespeare. If you're into pop music, popular music, you need to listen to Pet Sounds, because it's one of those classic albums. Despite the fact it's nearly 50 years old now, it's a real sort of influential album. A lot of the stuff we listen to today is influenced by this. Just listen to a few bars of it. To do that, all of the backing vocals were him. So it's a good album to listen to, and that track in particular. What I'm going to do this week, for the first time, I'm going to use my blog. I'll mention it right at the end, but I'm going to put a post up. I'll probably do it tomorrow morning at some point, and I'll put this Spotify playlist on the post. And what I'd like you to do is look at the post and respond to it. It's going to be based on what we're talking about today. Just put some comments up on the blog based on what you've listened to, your interpretation of what we're talking about today.
Can you send us a link to it?
It's on Blackboard. If you go into Blackboard, you know down the menu on the left,
yeah.
You'll see Paul Carr blog. Just click on it and it'll take you into it. Yeah. I think I've got a link at the end of this as well. So, other ways that the elements of music can help us determine the form. So we've already gone through loads of things. We've gone through how the bar numbers themselves can let us know that a new section's coming. We've talked about how various elements of music, when they're introduced, they help us realise, it's a new section. With that one, it was recorded all the time, but the introduction of these different backing vocals and bass guitars and keyboards, they help us as listeners differentiate between section one, section two, and section three. So the elements of music are helping us to realise what the form of the music is. And you'll find a lot that rhythm can do this as well. This is quite an old example, but I think it puts across the point that I'm trying to say. So you can tell when a new section is moving on because the rhythm is different. There's a change in the rhythm. Again, these are examples that maybe you can find better examples of this, and I'll use them in next year's lecture. I'm not joking, I will. Let's listen to a bit of this. So this one fits all of the criteria. It's got the intro.
So this is the first.
the rhythm sort of changes before it hits the chorus in a way, doesn't it? It sort of moulds into it. Maybe a better example. You get the idea though, don't you? Verse, which was made up of a particular rhythm, and it moves into a chorus. I think it's a better example than the Foo Fighters one, actually. But it's an example of how, you know, how rhythm can be used to delineate form. It helps us realise that a new section is arrived. So when you're listening to music now, you should really start to be able to do this. You start to listen to it. Where is it where the interest in the music is coming from? You know, how does it fulfill my expectations? Is it exactly as you would expect? Or are there some sort of, sort of alterations to the rules where you've got like extra sections in and stuff like that? And you'll find that it will, it's genre specific. Most of all the examples I'm playing here are like sort of traditional pop rock stuff. If you get into the genre of dance music, it's another set of rules again. Because quite often the people who are working in that, they're not sort of musicians in the traditional sense. So quite often if you try analysing a piece of dance music, I quite often find when I listen to it, you'll find that the melody doesn't necessarily fit in with the chords. I think of it and think, it sounds great, but it doesn't fit in with the rules of harmony. And the reason for that, of course, is they don't think vertically like we do. Or you might, if you write dance music, you know, you tend to think horizontally. So you put layers together horizontally, and what happens is you end up with what, in a traditional sense, is clashes in harmony. But of course, it's not a clash, it's a different genre of music. It's because it's thought horizontally as opposed to the way that most of us think vertically in terms of chords. It's not rocket science that you will get different. All of the examples that we've heard so far, I think, apart from one, the chorus has consisted of different chords. So you come to a chorus and the chords change. But sometimes in music, you'll find that the chords actually stay the same.
Chasing cars
is an example, actually. Yeah, it is, yeah. That is an example of where the verse and the chorus have got the same chords. And of course, what happens when you've got verse and chorus with the same chords? The interest has to come from somewhere else. It's not coming from the harmony. So as a songwriter, the interest has to come from somewhere. And this is probably the most famous one, for me anyway, of the verse and chorus being made with the same chords. But it's really pervasive throughout the history of popular music. Hendrix is All Along the Watchtower. Dylan's All Along the Watchtower, but I'm more familiar with the Hendrix version. But it's got the same chords for the verses, but it's got for the ends up same chords all the way through. It isn't a Creep by Radiohead. That's the same. It's got the same sort of chords for the verse, but listen to one of these maybe. And even, again, I looked at the top 20 over the weekend. The first track we listened to, All About That Bass, it's got the same chords for the verses, but it's got for the chorus. Let's just listen to that one. I'll not listen to the other three because we're running out of time. But let's just listen to that one again. Because that might be something you haven't thought about. You know, the interest comes from somewhere, but it's not from the chords.
I'm all about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass.
Let's try the chorus.
Except it was 50 years before, but it's the same idea.
In the night has come.
It's like a 1-6-2-5 version. You come across that 1-4-6-4-4-5. Some guitar solo type things, but it uses the same chords. And even Creep by Radiohead, it's the same idea. It's all made up of the same chords. It's just training your ears to live in edge of these sort of things.
Just like an angel. Skin makes me cry.
I mean, this is when Radiohead conformed all the rules. It's an 8-bar section, which is very unusual for them. Like the reason that it was a hit, the single was a chart that hit the chart. It's fitting in with a really good eight.
But I'm a creep. I'm a creep.
So basically what happens is, because the chords are the same, the interest comes from somewhere, throw a distorted guitar in there to add some interest.
That's great when a guitar announces I'm about to come in.
Yeah, you hear it just before.
Ripping guitar twice, yeah. And bang, it comes in.
Yeah.
It starts so mellow and then it just drives straight in.
Like, yeah. Yeah. Just before you guys started, but we had Ed O'Brien in here. Did you catch him? Was it the year before you started? The guitar player in Radiohead. I interviewed him over the Zen Room. I don't know if you guys were.
Michelle.
Might have been just before. Yeah, it was really interesting because he talked about the way they put together their records, which was really interesting. Not the way I thought at all. You know, they don't think of putting in complex time signatures. It just happens organically.
Okay, recorded, didn't you?
No.
What's the matter with you?
No, I only record me. Oh, you
should record him.
There we go. Hang on, let's put that back on. Yeah. Nearly there. Obviously, like I say, that what we do expect is that the melody will change between sections. And I would like to say to you, one of the things I don't mention at the end, but I'll ask you again, if you can find me a tune which has got the same melody for the chorus that it's got for the verse, it would be great, because I could mention it in the lecture next year. Last year, no one could find one, and I haven't been able to find one. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but it's difficult to find. But, you know, virtually everything we listen to has got a different melody for the chorus than it's got for the verse. What you also find in music, this is the last one, I think, is that, one more. Meter can determine form. So what you find sometimes, and it doesn't happen a lot in the sort of top 20 charts, but in a lot of music, you'll find that the chorus is in a different time signature from the verse. That's one very clear way of going, well, let's differentiate one section from another. Have one section in 4-4, have another section in a different time signature. There's loads of examples I could have chosen. I've tended to choose some of the examples are just songs that I like. So let's just listen to this and see if you can tell me what happens. What is the shift in time signature? This, of course, is Elton John's version of the Beatles. The Beatles did this originally. So what time signature are we in there?
3-4, is it?
Yeah, so it's in 3-4. It's a good way of...